Welcome back to the Modern Spirit Podcast. I am your host, Dr. Joe Taffer. We are now moving into episode 19 with Dr. Paul Mills. Wonderful discussion with Paul, my old friend, research mentor, and really a spiritual mentor to me. Paul was a professor of family medicine and public health and also the director of the Center of Excellence for Research and Training in Integrative Health at UCSD. He was also chief of the UC San Diego Behavioral Medicine Division, director of the UC San Diego Clinical Research Biomarker Laboratory, and co-director of the UC San Diego Clinical and Translational Research Institute's Translational Research Technology Program, the TRT. He is currently serving as director of research for the Chopra Foundation under Deepak Chopra. He has expertise in integrative medicine, traditional medical systems, and psychoneuroimmune processes in wellness and disease. He's published numerous manuscripts and book chapters on these topics. He's been an inspirational figure in many lives, in particular in my own life, helping guiding my unique career. So we sit and talk and look back on his career and look forward to his continued work bridging the spiritual and the scientific. Hope you enjoy it. Okay, welcome everybody back to the Modern Spirit Podcast. I'm very pleased to have one of my old friends, research mentor, spiritual mentor, most important person in my life, Dr. Paul Mills is here with us today. Thank you, Paul, for joining us.
Thank you, Joe. Pleasure. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Yeah, me too. So maybe I have a little intro, but I'd like you just to give us just a little bit about, where are you working? What have you been doing the last few years in regards to integrative medicine? And we'll get into the other matters.
Okay, sure. Well, as you know, I'm at the University of California, San Diego. I've been there a little over three decades. In the last 5 or 6 years, a focus of my work has been on this field of integrative medicine, sometimes called integrative health, which really evolved out of the complementary and alternative medicine movement, which evolved out of what was called the whole person medicine movement, started in the late 70s. And much of my work in integrative medicine the last few years has been focusing on studying traditional whole medical systems. A focus has been on Ayurveda, but I've also learned a bit about Tibetan medicine, a little bit about traditional Chinese medicine. I have some historical background knowing about Native American medicine. And of course, I would say that, as you know, all these traditional systems are really beautiful because they treat the entirety of the person. And it's the spiritual aspect of the person that I've been particularly interested in and studying and bringing knowledge of that into the research world and hoping that'll disseminate and translate into the medical world as well.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty much been the story all along with you, it seems like to me, right? And you know what's funny is that the Squadcast comes up with these little captions for people, like Hachamani, and yours is, I don't know how it determines this, unless you have this, because Rael's came up with something totally different in Chamonix. Yours says, courageous scientist.
I see that.
I mean, that's the AI.
No kidding.
As far as I know, I have nothing to do with that. What? So, courageous scientist. So, I mean, I think that's always been the case. And so you came into research that way and you've been kind of keeping that alive. And now it seems like you've had a lot more opportunities. I wanted to ask you just briefly before we just really get into the transcendent spiritual stuff and holistic medicine, et cetera, is, you know, you mentioned briefly, and I'm curious just because it's topical, this COVID paper with yoga and meditation. Could you give us a little bit of information on that, this paper you published?
Sure, happy to. And I'll tell you about the team first that we put the paper together, because that team is relevant to some of the more whole person medicine work I've been doing. And that originated from a chance encounter with Deepak Chopra. I met him at a conference about 6 years ago, and we started chatting, and we realized we had a lot of common backgrounds in the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi and TM, and certainly our work in integrative medicine. So this paper I can describe to you that we just published in JACM, Journal of Alternative Complementary Medicine. Mm-hmm. It's essentially a brief overview, a review of the literature of meditation research and yoga research, yoga asanas and postures relevant to COVID. And the team was, there's myself at UC San Diego and a colleague of mine who's an infectious disease epidemiologist. Her name is Dr. Kimberly Brower. And then we had a scientist at Massachusetts Institute of Technology. We had a couple of people from the Chopra Library, which is now part of what's called the Whole Health Institute, which is a new institute carrying forth much of the, integrative health work for the U.S.
Yeah.
And then we had two people from Harvard, including Michelle Williams, who's the dean of the School of Public Health there.
Wow.
And so the paper we had, we have a broad diversity of authorship, let's say. And the point of that was we had expertise. And so the paper discusses a variety of meditation literature showing how longer-term practice of meditation can have beneficial effects of lowering autonomic arousal and have subsequent parallel effects to reduce inflammatory biomarkers, CRP, interleukin 6, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
That's all relevant to the SARS-CoV-2 and COVID infectious disease process. And we also reviewed literature in that paper on another relevant part to the COVID story, which is stress, anxiety, social isolation, which so many of us have been hanging out in our homes for months. So just showing that things like the practice of yoga and meditation help make us more self-sufficient. We have a reference to self rather than our social network, and we can manage these sorts of things much better than people who have an orientation that's more other
yeah.
and more social activity. So that's the paper, and it just came out 2 days ago.
Oh, wow. No, that seems totally relevant, and I do hear people kind of talking about that, that people have spent more time kind of in their own, whether it's mindfulness or some kind of practice, they're having an easier time, you know, with the isolation and those people that haven't maybe gone inwards as much or, that it's more of a struggle.
Yes.
So, yeah, it is interesting to me how in this COVID, like all these things are just more and more relevant, you know, when we talk about managing, well, that it's really lifestyle is a huge part of what seems to be related to risk factors in COVID. It's not the only thing, but it's a major factor and mm-hmm. associated inflammatory stuff and then subsequent cascade that gets out of control in some individuals and the way that all this holistic medicine can help. And that brings us back to the larger topic. You know, for me, when I was at the lab and exploring traditional Amazonian plant medicine, and that was kind of like the beginning point in my book was using the personal mastery scale that was the step off point into talking about how the shamanism seemed to be affecting people's physical health was, well, their belief system about life, you know, was influential on, in this case, it was the Alzheimer caregiver burnout, right? Their ability to handle the stress of taking care of somebody with Alzheimer's was influenced by, what I would consider to be their belief system. And ultimately their belief system, you know, once we get into these more transcendent conversations, which is where we're headed, it's about a connection. You know, it's not, the belief is like simply describing a connectedness to something. Mm-hmm. And that those personal mastery questions are kind of about that. You know, to me, they were questions. I can't remember exactly what I could pull them up right now, but it's something like, you know, I have, you know, everything's kind of works out for me, or I have no power over the things that happen to me in my life. And to me, the way I boiled it down to it, there are questions that I would associate with faith. You know, what I would say, well, this person is more faith. About how life is going for them, their connection to the flow of life, and this person doesn't. And then seeing how that was related to their inflammatory kind of response. And then the guy I presented in the book was, you know, Russ was, I gave it to everybody, and it was your idea, like, hey, try it out on these guys when they're going to go through this intervention, a 10-day diet with the Shipibos, you know, entering a holistic
ancestral traditional medical system where spiritual connection is considered vital to the healing process. And yeah, everyone anecdotally in my little superficial little study of these people improved. But Russ was the PTSD case that we focused on, and he had a marked improvement. And he subsequently actually did have improvements in his hypertension and his diabetes, you know. And obviously there's lifestyle changes that go along with that and weight loss and things, but there was some kind of a downshift in his body system. Even on the second time, just to throw this out there, then I want to hear from you, but I'm just throwing these things at you. You know, because you've done a lot of hypertension research, you know, one thing that after spending time with you that I talk about a lot with people is just how psychogenic hypertension is, or psychosomatic, how much perhaps emotional burdens and things like that and stresses contribute. You know, the second time I took Russ down, we did 3 weeks, and obviously he was on the plant diet and no salt and, you know, very healthy for 3 weeks. But at the end of it, he got anxious because he has a history of coronary artery disease and had a bypass. So the day after when we finished, without consulting me, he got anxious and just said, oh, I'm off the diet. I better take all my meds. And he took all of his meds at their doses that he was on before. And he passed out. You know, he went syncopal. You know, his blood pressure was lowered medically beyond, you know, his baseline had dropped so much that his drugs were dangerous. You know, a borderline had to take him to the hospital. But he recovered once we stopped the medication and his blood pressure normalized. It was an experience around that where obviously he had a big physical cleansing, purging type of experience, but he had a major forgiveness journey that he went through and a lot of like spiritual connection and contact. But those are some of the things that were, DePaul, your influence is very directly, you know, influenced my path and my journey around that stuff. But I think it's fascinating and it's the frontier, I guess, that we're at right now, right? Is to see how this spiritual connection may be beneficial to our health.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. And I remember you telling me about that particular person you brought down, and I hadn't heard the medication.
That was
story.
The second time. That was after, yeah. A couple years later.
That's dramatic. But yeah, and you mentioned hypertension, and as you know, 95% of hypertension is classified as essential hypertension, meaning there's no organic cause. It's something related to the mind or behavioral factors, diet, exercise, and so forth. So yeah, it's easy to turn around. But I particularly appreciated what you were saying about the mastery piece. And as you were describing that, what I also hear is meaning. And people who have mastery have a greater sense of meaning. And they also have an innate belief and knowledge that they can manage anything in their life that comes their way. And that's self-efficacy, another piece of the self-efficacy puzzle. But meaning, human beings, we need meaning. We can get it through faith. We can get it through a variety of modes, let's say. But a person who has a sense of meaning and the connectivity that provides will always have a richer life, and I consider that part of the foundation of well-being. You might not always have perfect physical mm-hmm. health, but you're going to have well-being as far as a spiritual, psychosocial health and well-being. And that's what's always in our power. Our health isn't always in our power, as you know. As a physician, we can do all the right things and still things can happen to us physically, adversely, let's say. But we can always manage our relationship to what's going on in our life, including our body and our health.
Right. That was Viktor Frankl, right? He was big in logotherapy. Do you know about Viktor Frankl? Psychiatrist. He's a concentration camp survivor that wrote about it. And that was his thing, was it's mm-hmm. about meaning. He realized that the people that had meaning were able to get through it, and the people that didn't, you know, it was much more difficult. And he discovered that there, and he created this thing called logotherapy, you know, based on the premise that the primary motivational force of an individual is to find a meaning in life. But what, you know, when we say meaning, like, it's How is it getting defined in the literature, or how do you approach it? Like, how can we talk about meaning? What are we talking about?
I can speak about it from my point of view as of what would be the ultimate meaning, because yeah, there's all kinds of varieties. You can have a person having meaning because they're on Wall Street knocking down massive amounts of money, and that's meaningful to them. Depends on the relationship to it. But for me, getting back to our earlier offline conversation about the traditional medical systems recognizing and helping an individual recognize of our spiritual nature beyond the temporalness of our mind and body. To me, that's really true meaning. When a person can know that they are really an eternal feature of the universe itself and ultimately a conscious manifestation of that, how much more meaning would one need, particularly in relationship to how most of us are often reared socially, where we can just not even feel connected to ourselves, let alone our neighbors and our communities, but to come into a conscious awareness that you really are foundationally part of and the universe itself. I think that's the ultimate meaning. And when a person can have that realization, it's a foundation of well-being, and then a foundation for further exploration of what does it mean to be a human being? What is our potential as a human being? And then what do you want to do with it? Once you've come into realizing that, what do you want your life to be about?
Yeah, that's pretty awesome. Yeah. So recognizing our spiritual nature, like connecting with our foundational, there's so many different ways to conceptualize that, like you said, I was talking to one thing that we talk about sometimes, and I mentioned him before, but I hung out with him yesterday, so it comes to mind, is my friend Daryl Slim, the Navajo medicine man. And so we got into this discussion about he's into this. He's at all these little systems that he reports are from the songs. You know, the songs are delineating these different systems and looking at things. And one of them was this, like we were talking about, you know, just he was just saying like a tree, for example, just pure energy consciousness. You know, that it's living that meaning. That's it. That's how what he was suggesting, you know, that we were just talking about. It's fully realized in that meaning, a tree. And then there's like spirit is somehow like he was trying to say that for him, that concept is somehow like our mental approach to that, to the being, to the energiness. Like that's how we talk about it. It's like, the spirit of the tree. And he's like, what we're really trying to indicate is this, you know, it's deeper energetic being, but since we can't quite express that, then we use the spirit approach. And then he was saying, well, then there's the soul, you know, as we kind of reflect that into ourselves, and then that's, we acknowledge our humanity, but really once we do that and are able to just recognize ourselves, then it's just so that we can once again, you know, experience the energetic beingness of this, of the universe, you know, of what we are. And so he has different, another concept from the songs that he always brings up is that, he's like, well, the stone, that's the sleeping consciousness. So that's, the stone exists as sleeping consciousness, and we have to go to that. We have to be stone sometimes. And then the plant is dreaming consciousness. Like it's sitting still, just dreaming into the space. And then the animal is awakened consciousness. Now it's moving around. And then the human is awakened to themselves. Yeah.
I like this description.
So this is from the Navajo songs. Like this is the philosophy that's woven into the song. So then his big thing is always, the human is awakened to themselves, but then they go to the animal and track the animal, and the animal guides them to the plant, and then the plant, you know, shows them about what they can learn from the stone, and then it comes all the way back, and then they awaken to themselves, you know, through this play.
And the that cosmology, the human that awakens to themselves, what are they awakening to? what does the human ultimately become aware of that they are?
Right.
Since they have that capacity.
I mean, it sounds to me very much along the lines of what you're talking about, which is their eternal spiritual nature. Mm. And but there's, you know, there's levels of that. So like that also, this whole system exists within this other system, cycles of life, this cycle of the way of life. So in other words, there is this spiritual, you know, awakening about your own nature and the timelessness, and as he calls it, the always, always. You know, that's his sign off all the time on the phone, always, always, that we all laugh about. But it's there's that. But then also within that is telling the story of the lifespan, you know, that the lifespan is still, it's a celebrated part of that awakening. In other words, you know, rites of passage of different age, you know, the puberty ceremony and the birth ceremony and the marriage ceremony and these different stages of life and becoming a grandparent. And, you know, that these stages of life are also very revered, like the human life and existence and its microcosm to the macrocosm of the universe. And yet at the same time, then here we are, we're everything. So it's awakening to our deepest spiritual nature and, I guess, to the magic of the human life and the human lifespan and even beyond lifespans, you know, and even some considerations of reincarnation and things like that in the mix, you know. So I think it's the spiritual, it's meaning throughout through our whole existence, I guess, you know, not simply just us acknowledging the eternal infinite, but also like the journey. The meaning and the journey.
I think that's number one, the meaning. I mean, I'm thinking of several things as you're speaking. One, I'm thinking of the Tao. And of course, the Tao says it's not about where you're heading. The Tao is the way. That's right. How you translate that word, right? So it's just the journey itself and the importance of having a, say, a proper journey or having the awareness around. So if humans are the awakened consciousness, we all know that there's a variety, there's a range of what that could mean. Some people are not very awake, mm-hmm. and others are more awake. So to live a life, I guess that implies in the Navajo tradition, if a person has lived a life and they haven't awakened to the human consciousness, then we've missed why we're here, or the potential, right? Because an awakened human being realizes their own spiritual nature is the same as the spiritual nature of the plant and the rock and everything else. The foundationally, right? I mean, yeah. I'm reminded I had an appointment this morning and driving over there, I was reflecting on some things like this, just about the, because I had a call earlier this morning with a psychiatrist, psychoanalyst in New York City, and we were discussing a research project potentially mm-hmm. around ketamine and low ketamine for helping people certainly overcome various pathologies they might have, but really as a way to activate well-being in them. And then that sense of well-being, once they've identified, oh, this is it, then that can be their new center. So I was then driving this appointment, and I was reflecting on just the uniqueness about being a human being. And it's a challenging phenomenon, really. And most of us as people would recognize that. And I was thinking, well, why is that? And as you're describing, we have these very intricate lifespans with different stages. And certainly many of the traditional cultures had such wisdom that they created ceremonies and rituals around different phases of the human life to support that person through that span, from, you know, a young kid to adolescent or middle age and old age. Why? Because it's an orientation and it provided a sense of meaning. Okay, I'm 65 now. Okay, what is this phase of my life about? Is that I'm feeling the need to make a transition, as you know, I think we've talked about it. Move away from the university. Move into a new phase. What's that new phase going to be? What am I going to focus on? So to speak, who do I want to be now? And it's important for us to really have a clear contact, I think, deep within ourselves, our subconscious realms as well as our conscious realms to coalesce and identify what that is. So we have the meaning, we have the bliss as we move forward to the next phase. I can't just keep hanging on to the way it used to be. That's a recipe for an unpleasant.
Yeah.
But I was thinking about, so with all that complexity about human beings, and I was thinking about the challenge of that, and partly that we are the that, right? You know, the Eastern philosophy, I am that, thou art that, all this is that, this realization that we really are God, the consciousness of God, the awareness of God, perceiving through this, what we call mortal form, and these, with all the different cycles and trends and growths and decays within that. And I was just thinking how much of a challenge that is. It's a gift, it's a beautiful gift, but to balance the immense inheritance of being the divinity in a form that's so constantly changing through the cycle of a human life, and to master what's going on being a human being, all the while we're at it. But within internally within ourselves, having that simultaneous knowledge and awareness of what we are spiritually.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, that's it. He, you know, just one of the things that he was talking about yesterday, just to add to the same kind of conversation, is in the morning looking at himself in the mirror and seeing, like, in his face, you know, because we have the pure spiritual, but in his face seeing the story of his ancestors, like, oh, I look kind of like my dad, or oh, I'm becoming more like this, or the grandfather, or it's the ancestral, like karmic, you know, the flesh, the genetics, all that stuff. It's like, there it is. Like, just in the morning, I have to say hi to all of them because I'm living it. I, you know, obviously I'm more than that, or I'm everything and I'm that. You know, this whole thing of what you're talking about, mastering it and living it, you know, and that's the magic of it. And I guess we encounter it sometimes. We see some people doing some things where they just feel like their spirit is so alive in what they're doing. You know, they so feel so realized, right?
And what is that? As you were speaking it, I'm thinking those are the people who have come into a great acceptance of who they are. Versus always being in some internal wrestling and conflict. Oh, I'm not good enough, or I'm not who I wanted to be. But you have to be whatever you are at that present time, fully accepting it. Which I think brings in a kind of a harmony and back to a sense of meaning. I think it's like, you know, if we're in a, I was in college, I was in a couple of plays. So I memorized the lines and I had a certain outfit to put on. And then I would get on stage. And it was much more enjoyable when I completely surrendered and was in flow with me being that character. But if I was assigned by the director, you know, the theater director, well, Paul, I'm going to have you play this person, but no, I really wanted to play that person. No, you have to play this person. And so I let do the lines, and I wasn't quite as enjoyable experience if I was not, if I didn't surrender to the fact that, you know what, I'm this character. I'm not the one I'm going to be. I think it's the same for our human life. You know, we've incarnated, and, you know, some people have more insight into this, but We chose the you know, the parents we were born into, the time, the place, the setting, the culture, all for the purpose of unfolding a very specific set of experiences to experience them, to find meaning, to find purpose, to find enjoyment, you know, the divine play, so to speak. So that's a good way to start. Just accept the fact that, hey, I set this up. It's an amazing life. I'm going to get as much out of it as I can by surrendering to it and experiencing the depth of it and not just fighting, kicking and screaming.
Oh, that seems very powerful. The acceptance is it, you know, I was watching on, there's this new Netflix. I was watching yesterday a little bit, which is, I liked it a lot. It's, I think it's called Home, and it's about these like kind of obscure cultural sports that people just love so much. And some of them are like 5,000 years old or older. In these different places where it's like such a part of the identity of these places. There's a game, it was in Kyrgyzstan, and I can't remember, but they, you know, it's their horse masters, and they play, it used to be with a dead wolf, and now they play with a dead goat. And it's like a polo game, and it's really rough. And they're really, you know, and they have to throw this goat in a big hole. And it's really difficult, you know, like it's a hardcore thing. You got to be really grow up riding horses and all that stuff. And these guys are like, this is who we are, you know, like we're, this is the spirit of us is this, like Kyrgyzstan. This is, we are this, and we are like, we do this. So they, you know, they're from these cultures. They're from these, like, born into a place where they get to live it and be this tradition. Like, and of course there's new frontiers. You know, time is changing and things shift, but still they get to like really embody that. You know, and then there's other, like, you know, let's say our modern life over here in this culture where it's so much about change and this frontier. We it can't just step into the tradition of this or that. It's like we don't know where it's going. It's all, it's something new is happening, right? I mean, your whole career, courageous scientist, and what I'm doing, you know, it's also just like, so there's confusion. I guess there's confusion either way, but it's funny to hear these guys who are just like so into what they, and it reminds me, there's another episode where they're in the Philippines. Oh no, where are they? I don't know. I don't remember where they are. But I can't remember in this moment, but it's in Southeast Asia somewhere, and they are rice paddies, as Bali. They're in Bali, and so there's rice paddies in Bali, and these guys race ox plows. Like they just have these other oxen. They got two, and they use it like a chariot, and it's like what they do after work. And they've been doing it forever, and they just love it. But these guys are out there; they're rice farmers. You know, like they cut their rice. This like they have a very simple life, or very clear as far as what are they doing here. And when I lived in the village in Peru, you know, there was a lot of that where there was so much more. It was kind of obvious to them, you know, what they had been born into. Although they may want to try other things and live another thing, but there's something about this modern life that somehow seems more confusing about accepting, you know, what we are.
Agreed. When I've been exposed to cultures that have these rich traditions, I always muse to myself that I would enjoy that very much, having that sense of connection to place and connection to people. And you know, I haven't had that. I mean, I'm really we don't have those kind of long-standing traditions. What traditions have I had?
Yeah.
Okay, we have a birthday party every year. You know, that's sort of not really, it's not really grounded in kind of the body and the earth. Where,
well, surfing has been something for you, I think, that tradition connects you to, it's an activity. It's a cultural activity.
Yeah. It's a cultural activity. Maybe it would have been different if my father had taught it to me and then his grandfather. We had this little compound on the beach for the last 500 years.
So then it's this meaning and finding this meaning and accepting what we're, the life we're born into, I suppose, as you're saying, or that we've chosen spiritually to walk this way. And so,
So let me comment on that because it reminds me. So you know, I'm writing this book and interviewed you, and it has to do with the spiritual life of scientists, with the idea of who's behind this effort to reunite spirituality and science. Right? We've had this so-called rift. And religion and spirituality has suffered from it, and certainly science and what we could be gleaning from science has suffered from it, because in science, as you know, spirituality has been kind of taboo. You can't study the mystical. You can't use these massive amounts of resources of modern mainstream science to study the mystical, which is essentially our nature. So we've missed probing into that. So when I've been interviewing scientists such as yourself, as I was listening to each person's story, I found myself thinking about, you know, the hero, the heroine's journey. You know, Joseph Campbell laid out this classical mythology, the hero with the thousand faces, that no matter where a person lives, whatever culture they grew up in across the world, there are these common mythologies, stories about the lifespan of a human being. Of course, there's small journeys within each life, but then there's the ultimate journey. And it brought me back to reading a book, which I'm in the midst of right now, a collection of his lectures. And this gets back to this transcendent story, which we're speaking about. So that's why I'm telling you this part of the story. So Joseph Campbell had been studying mythology for a couple of decades. He thought he had a sense of it. And then he realized he needed to go to India for some reason to really get deeper into the understanding of it. So he's in India roaming around, and he says to himself, you know, I have some questions and I need to find a real life master, not somebody who says they're a master or not, but somebody who's really fully realized. And through some serendipity, he finds somebody, and he sits down and sits in front of this guru, and the guru says, do you have a question? And of course, he had a question. So he asked the question, and he ends up having a nice conversation with this guru, because in part because it turned out the question Joseph Campbell asked that guru was the same question that guru as a young man had asked his potential guru. And the question was this, which in many ways I think relates to what we've been speaking about so far. And Campbell asked him this question. He said, look, if the entirety of the world is Brahman, and Brahman means the totality of the Godhead through what we call material and non-material form, just everything and everything to do with the human life, the good, the bad, the so-called ugly, all of it. If all of this is Brahman, then why do we fuss with it? Why do we come into conflict with it? Why do we have trouble with what people consider hard times versus easy times? And why don't people just accept it all as it is, because it's all Brahman, it's all God and the play and display? So the answer from this guru was, well, you and I don't ask those questions because we see it as it is, but what I recommend you do to get more insight is, and he taught him some form of meditation, which had to do with paying attention between the experience between thoughts. Well, what's between thoughts? It's our awareness, our essential spiritual nature beyond thought, beyond the mind. And so Campbell started practicing this and gave him more insight. And the point that I'm telling you that related to the book is that in many ways, that's the ultimate hero's journey. For a human being to go beyond the mind, beyond the experience of thoughts, of ritual, of all of it and any of it, to arrive at their essential nature, their spiritual nature, the ultimate hero or heroine's journey is to discover their identity. You know, beyond a lot of these journeys, you know, the knight goes off and then the heroine goes off and accomplishes something, leading to a form of individuation where they develop their more human gifts and human personality and bring it back to the culture. I am here. I've mastered this. You've mastered medicine and enriched it with traditional medicine, and you go back to your culture and you offer that gift. Yeah. And then a continuity of that is also coming into a realization of the spiritual, your spiritual being, and having that as perspective of everything you do going forward.
So, to just be the fool. So Joseph Campbell says this to him, and you know, okay, why do we struggle with this? And you know, he just basically directs him to, hey, you need to spend more time with the Brahman, basically. Like you're just
your own Brahman. He was Brahman.
Yeah, just do that, and you're there. It's you that's looking at that or struggling with that. It's simply a distraction from just the realization.
Yeah, I think we're in several parts of our conversation, we're talking about this balance between coming into a life of acceptance and meaning for what is versus having a life where we're constantly beating against all these things we don't fully understand. And I'm not in any way arguing coming into acceptance and meaning means we stand by things that we perceive as not just in the world,
right?
And that we don't want to use our abilities, you know, whatever those abilities are, to make change. But to do that from within a position of kind of equanimity and a peace in ourselves that we can transfer into whatever our efforts are in the world. If I'm full of hatred and I'm going to go fix this and fix that, that's a bit poisonous to what I'm going out there to try to remedy.
Right.
But to have come into some kind of surrendered space of an equanimity from my own being and for what is at this moment, then I think that's a, more of a foundation for, I think, you know, transformation. And I think, isn't that what a lot of the traditional cultures and perhaps some of the wisdom, at least, of some of the religions advocates that?
No, definitely. I think to find, you know, for me, I guess one of my focuses has been, and or, you know, it's, I guess it's a compartmentalization or something, but as you relate to people and as a doctor or finding different ways to approach people, it's, you know, finding peace in their mind, finding peace in their hearts, you know, the emotional peace. So like you said, they're not bringing this anger, this frustration into these other, you know, bringing that toxic energy or something from the past into something that's going on right now and getting in the way, or also just peace of mind that they're not suffering so much with what's going on in their head, you know, being in the way of being able to experience or express themselves the way they'd like to, or where they feel more peaceful about. So that's definitely, and then that gets back to what we talked about a little bit in the book interview, which is this same concept that I was relating to the Native American culture, but, you know, definitely there are many other cultures that seem to indicate this, is just that this search for meaning and spirituality, and you've already said it, is the same as our search for well-being, you know, which ultimately could be, you know, correlated to our health, at least the part of our health that we can impact. And so that we're really just talking about health at the same time, you know, isn't it, you've been involved in health research all this time as you've been exploring this, the role of meaning in our lives. So it's, they're very linked, aren't they?
Gratitude, we did some research on gratitude, which to me, I also find is very healing for persons, not only their mind and their spiritual sense, but also the physical body itself. I think gratitude is another powerful, safe feature of our soul, we could say, when we activate it, that helps our health and well-being. I think it provides a sense of meaning too. And why I say that is, I think when people go to meaning, kind of bring it into their soul space, their heart space, it provides a sense of connectivity to the environment around them. It takes them out of a more of an ego consciousness into a sense of connectedness of everything. And that, to me, gives them a sense of oneness. And in many ways, when you're describing the traditional cultures, certainly Native American cultures, they knew everything was one. They didn't experience themselves as separate. The sky and the earth and everything is one. That was their perception. That was their knowledge. I mean, living in a state of oneness versus living as a separate entity, and I'm just an observer. I'm like a foreigner in this land I live in. That's not very comforting. It's separation, and I don't think it's not natural. So that also cultivates a sense of anxiety, a sense of angst, because you're a foreigner in your own planet, your own land. You know, it's not.
Yeah, that's very uncomfortable. I think there's. So we're talking a little bit about this meaning, and that's one thing that I seem to encounter was just that this is like a felt sense, right? That this meaning is a felt sense, that this is a subjective, you know, reality, as they would call it. You know, it's some Sigmund Freud book, I pulled that line out of, subjective reality, subjective fact. You know, in other words, when we all feel this certain music and everyone is touched by it in this certain way, it's like it's just common sense that, yes, we did all just experience that is... that's real to us. And so then this idea that you know, like ketamine, for example, like trying to, and that's kind of, it's getting popularity as a spin-off a little bit of the psychedelic, you know, psychotherapy movement, right? That they, people are doing this kind of work with MDMA or even psilocybin, and then they're realizing that, hey, we could do it with ketamine, where people are having these psycholytic experiences, they're calling it, where we can walk them into these, sometimes it's a felt experience, an emotional experience, like help guide them to stay there and hold the line and kind of get past their judgment and get past that and just and feel it until they get somewhere. And so they're, but what they're getting to, like you said, is it's kind of a felt sense of like, oh wow, this is what healthy, warm-hearted, loving, nurturing kind of or peaceful, this is the good feeling that I should be. In the end, similarly, this is also feels like it's mystical, it's beyond time and space, and it's oceanic boundlessness, that it's connected to that as well, and that's maybe what I should be reaching for. You know, that's been kind of a, you know, that's been one of the things about psychedelic medicine that I've been involved in is like, okay, you're helping people find this good feeling, and so they can remember that's the one I'm looking for. Or, you know, I mean, you don't want to overly attach to the feeling or this particular state, but there's something about that, like you said, I didn't grow up in the Hawaiian tradition and the family compound by the beach and learn surfing from my grandfather and, you know, all that, to where it's just so like clear to me how I'm connected to the ocean and connected to everything. But still, you know, I've been stoked, you know, I've had a good wave and felt great about it and just been like, yeah, like, wow, this yeah, is what I say. We've had it together. It's like, this is what it feels like to be connected to the ocean, to the world and to everything. And it's beautiful. And there's so much beauty here and all of that. I don't know. I guess it's just, that's what I hear people, you know, kind of like, that's what happens sometimes with the ayahuasca and the psychedelic psychotherapies. They're kind of introduced to love. They're introduced to gratitude. They're introduced to acceptance, you know, which are kind of in a way like states of being that are tuned in to this universal energy, it seems to me.
Yeah. I mean, is it true that implicit in all that type of work is that we're getting a person more to their true nature versus, well, what you've been experiencing is your nature, and we're just going to show you something new. Mm-hmm. Always the sense that we're taking you back to your essential nature, kind of your reality that you've unfortunately forgotten about for a variety of reasons. But this is what you forgot. Here, this is you. This is your potential sense of connectedness, the felt sense, and on and on. If that's the case, then that to me explains why it's so incredibly healing.
I think that's very well put. And I think that is that, because there are other people that are taking it in other directions, but I think the true heart and soul of it in my own experience is about what you're talking about. And that, you know, and that gets us back to meditation, you know, mindfulness practices also help, and other spiritual practices, helping people get to the same kind of place. And as I see the ketamine kind of popping up, but, you know, like Terrence McKenna, who's a big psychedelic psychonaut, but I think maybe taking it too far in that direction personally, but one of the lines that he threw out there about what is this good for was like, these are deconditioning agents. Like, in other words, there's a deconditioning process. The healing process is a deconditioning process of helping us come back to our essential nature. And that's very, you know, that's like Daryl, you know, Navajo, that's very much there, you know, that we just need to get back. The system works, you know, the system heals, cut your skin open. It's going to start closing up, you know, it works, but you've got to reveal its full potential.
I appreciate the way that person speaks about that, and Daryl as well. And they're deconditioning agents. Mm-hmm. They kind of help remove loosen the veil between what we're experiencing in our nature, our capacity.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So as we say that, and talking about, you know, the, again, the hero's journey, that we're moving through different phases of life and at different points, things are presented to us, whether it's a teacher or a gift from a teacher, which could be a, you know, medicinal plant and so forth. But things come our way to that we can expose ourselves to and embrace to help us along that journey of, in this case, self-remembrance.
Yeah, exactly. No, that's it. Yeah. And that is, and there isn't that a mysterious, magical thing, the way I think, obviously, like you're saying, in a more awakened journey, when you recognize that that's happening in a particular moment, that, oh, wow, this is how, you know, then that's the acceptance piece, when you realize this is, these are gifts. You know, it's easy to say, but some of our difficult experiences, you know, become blessings of increased awareness, you know, and appreciation.
I've experienced mm-hmm. that. I didn't know precisely in the moment.
Right.
You know, we say to ourselves, God, I'm in the thick of it right now, so you can't see very well.
Right.
But you know you're going through something difficult, transformational. And then when you come out the other side, then the capacity for awareness around it is greater.
Yeah.
And then they appreciate it. But I would say, as I've had some of those during the course of my life, once I had a few of them under my belt, I then could carry that awareness more easily, even during the tough time.
Right.
I knew something good was happening.
Yeah.
So I was able to stick with it and have awareness, because I think awareness at any one moment, regardless of what it is, enriches the experience itself, and maybe, depending, also makes it easier,
right,
to go through.
So expanding awareness helps. I mean, let's say with meditation, mindfulness, or whatever it is. In other words, being with expanding awareness. You know, raising awareness, as we say, that it helps. That it's sometimes it's painful to see and be aware of certain things, you know, that you'd rather not look at, but ultimately it's going to make the journey easier.
Well, that gets at, you know, the whole shadow concepts in the Jungian and Freudian and others, psychology. If it's painful to look at, well, what does that mean?
Mm-hmm.
That's part of life. So why is it painful to you?
Right.
There's some shadow, unaccepted element of that experience. And so that needs to be revealed, and you come into a different relationship, and that liberates energy.
Yeah.
Which is part of your psyche and your soul, and then you're a little more enriched, and life going forward is more enriched.
More invigorated, perhaps, as well.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, quite a quick question. The gratitude research that you're involved in, what was looked at? What was examined?
Sure. A couple of things, but all the work was done in people with various stages of cardiac disease. And we did a couple of studies. The first study was a simple correlational study of about 200 patients, and we just gave them a gratitude questionnaire. There are those, if you didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
There's several of them. They basically measure a person's trait gratitude. How much gratitude do they carry in their awareness all the time?
Yeah.
Like an attitude of gratitude. So we gave that to a couple hundred patients, and we used those scores to correlate with their physical functioning and BNP levels, which is, as you know, a cardiac biomarker, depression, and so forth. And those who had more trait gratitude were much healthier within that range of within the cardiac disease syndrome. So then, based on those results, we did a randomized trial, and we had a group of patients keep a gratitude journal for 2 months. And every day, most days of the week, we told them to sit down and write a few things they were grateful for every day. Could be a sentence, could be a word, could be pages, whatever they wanted to do. And after those 2 months, we reassessed them on their blood and psychosocial measures and physical functioning and cardiac functioning. And those who did the gratitude journaling, they had significant improvements. I mean, clinically relevant significance, not just p-value significance. There, we did heart rate variability. and that improved for them, for their heart functioning. We did a handful of biomarkers, inflammatory biomarkers, BNP and others. And those biomarkers went down about 22% over 2 months, which is amazing. Those patients who had just kept on doing their normal treatment as usual showed no change, which is what you typically expect to see. So this was very powerful just by these patients reflecting on what they're grateful for in their life day after day, week after week. It had a transformation, not only of their psyche, but of their physical health and their heart in particular, which is what we were looking at. Mm. And I mean, I looked at that as, you know, gratitude is one of the, considered one of the virtues. I look at it like a, it's like a soul characteristic. Mm-hmm. And when we tap into features of our soul, it's innately healing to our psyche and then the body itself.
Right.
And then also said earlier that I think gratitude by being willing to be grateful for something means we're stepping out of our own self into whatever it is out there we're feeling grateful for. Could be another person, could be, you know, the divinity, whatever. But that openness and connectedness, that openness, we're overcoming our egotism at that moment.
Right.
And we're in a state of a kind of a oneness, a connectedness, which implicitly means we're no longer isolated. There's less separation that most people typically experience. And that in itself is healing because it's more of who we are.
Essential nature.
Innately. It's our nature. We're stepping closer to our nature. And then we remember, and everything about us goes, ah, yeah, this feels right. Mm-hmm. I got to keep journaling.
Yeah, no, it's true. I think I mentioned to you one time that a friend of mine, kind of from a Buddhist meditation perspective, she was talking about gratitude as a frequency to tune into. You know, that it's an energy that you could, a state to tune into that is a higher dimensional frequency. You could, anyways, transpersonal, beyond the ego, like what you're saying. You know, what you're talking about. A chance to step beyond your ego, and then there's this, you know, there's all, it blurs the distinction between you and everything, so you get to, you know, experience the essential nature, and I can't remember right in this moment what I was just gonna say because I was getting into it, but you just the acceptance, you know. The acceptance piece that you were talking about before, the gratitude, it's like somehow acceptance helps people be more grateful, and being grateful helps people accept. You know, it's because like you said, it opens that, the consciousness beyond the ego, and so you can experience things that, you know, I think sometimes things are too, for our little ego structure world, it's too much voltage for there, you know. You need to open a capacity that's broader for that to kind of work its way out and resolve and process and dissolve and expand. You know, our little lives are too small, really, for a lot of what we feel and experience, which I guess makes sense if that's our essential nature, is beyond that.
Thank you for putting it that way. And I think that gets back to what I was trying to share earlier about these thoughts I was having driving over to my appointment this morning. That we are the divinity in form, and the divinity brought forth the entirety of this universe, and yet that part of us, that inheritance of what we are, is operating in this flesh and limited space body. That's a challenge, I think.
Yeah.
You know, the way you were just putting it, we have this phenomenal inner capacity for experience, awareness, reflection, and so forth, and to be doing it in this changing world, moment to moment, of lots of potential challenges to our own existence physically,
yeah,
depending on the environment. Yeah, I think that's mastery. When you get that figured out, that's really remarkable.
Uh-huh.
And then I think perhaps more gifts and insight unfold from there as far as our capacity.
You know? Yeah, yeah. Well, I think it's the... It's staying connected, you know, to the larger field, as it were, so that you can process things from that, with that added capacity, you know, because
that's part of the gifts of the plants to us, right? Like the ayahuasca that you use and other plants.
Yeah, that's the hope and the idea. And then, but in that journey, you know, we have the human side there for us to kind of muddy the waters extensively. And for the spirit, or, you know, what we consider to be spirit, you know, for the trickster journey of it as well, like that we learn things so many different ways. Like you said, why would we, you know, like back to Joseph Campbell's question, it's like, why would we want to learn things this way? And then you learn it and you realize, well, how else could we have learned it? You know, I had to learn it that way. And so there's that journey that's like, you know, you couldn't, the wise person, you know, the 80-year-old, the 90-year-old's perspective on life, and like, oh, well, this had to kind of happen like that. You know, that's how that kind of thing goes. Versus when you're in the thick of it, like you said, that it's very hard to understand. So there's a lot of that, I think, in the ayahuasca realm to consider, just to mention that. But there's room for confusion, but to do it well and to do it healthy, that yes, you know, it's a gift. And that's one thing that, you know, Ricardo, my teacher, we were at the Spain conference and somebody was asking that question about, you know, the Shipibo perspective, and we've talked about this a little bit, but in expanding consciousness and reaching up and out, that there are perspectives, well, we have to clean, you know, it's the deconditioning. That's what you need. You know, we need to clean. But some people were kind of offended because they're like, oh, well, we're just trying to raise our consciousness. We're not sick. Why do you have to talk about it? Like always healing, always medicine. I'm doing my spiritual practice. I'm doing my spiritual growth, but I'm not sick. Why do you have to talk about it that way? And so then, you know, Ricardo gave him this long history of the origins of it all. But it was basically that the divinity gave us the plants to open the door to the divinity. But for us to expand our experience of the divinity, we have to clean. And so it has nothing to do with, you know, your ego about being sick or not sick. It's just, it's clearing out the things that are not your essential nature, and it can help you to do that. But we have to be careful about that, because we're human and there's ego, and we can mix it up. You know, we can project a lot onto the plants as well.
Yep.
You know, and that's something that I'm going through in my own life with my relationship with it, and being able, and that's what I was talking, where I started with Daryl, something that I was talking to him about is how concepts like, and what we talked to, you know, Ricardo's master about is like, you know, the tools of the mythology and the tools of a particular system, whether it's Ayurveda or Shipibo medicine or yoga or certain meditation schools, where we say, okay, this is the way to do it. You know, but then when we find ourselves straying outside of the way, or we find ourselves reaching in, like you said, in the gratitude experience beyond that, we realize, oh my God, this is actually beyond that, and allowing ourselves to transcend again, you know, mind and ego and limitations again, and realizing that the plant was already there. You know, that's what Daryl's whole thing with me is, like, they're already in the energy consciousness, like you're assigning them this, overly assigning this personality and what they're trying to teach you, but really they're just waiting for you to come back to that, you know, to being.
That's I get that clearer now, the way you
just
put it.
That it's because it was harder because I didn't give you the backstory, but the backstory is this long story. But it was that where I was, I had a story and an experience, a felt experience in my ayahuasca journeys around, oh, the plants want me to do this. You know, like there's us choosing, you said, from before birth and our journey. And then there's those moments when we feel like, oh, this is what I'm being assigned. This is the mission that I have, or what is my mission? I just want to follow orders, you know, and then sometimes that breaks down. And then I want to blame the plant. Why did you tell me that? What, I was getting this message from you, you know, and that whole thing. But then ultimately it was like, it's waiting for me on the other side of that, because it's still going to be there, pure energy, pure being, when I'm finished with that, you know. And so there's some journey I had to go on, this hard journey that that Joseph Campbell's complaining about, you know, why do we have to go through it? And he's just saying, meditate. Well,
he wasn't complaining so much that we have to go through it. It was more complaining, why do people complain about it?
Right. All right.
Because it's all God's show. So why are we fighting it?
Yeah.
Participating in it with more willingness and more love and acceptance.
Right.
And that provides some meaning because, wow, I'm in the midst of God's story here and the totality of the universe.
Right.
Who am I to fight it and complain about it? I'll do my part and see what my part is as it unfolds.
But the advice given was the meditation practice. Spend more time between your thoughts.
Yeah. Yeah, so that he could come more into a conscious experience of the beingness behind the show, so to speak.
Mm, right.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Go ahead.
One other thing. I appreciated what you were saying just then about the plants and that they're in that space already and they allow us to step into that consciousness, energetic space to provide our healing. That's the way you were putting it, right?
Yes.
That's their gift to us.
Yes.
And in that space that they provide to us, we have our healing and our insights and move along our journey.
Yes. Ideally, yes, yeah. That's it. And as you said, that it should be about helping us, for me, I believe, return to our essential nature, you know, and not necessarily change, you know, I don't know, just throw away, you know, whatever we've had up to now. It's like it's about returning to an essential nature, and that it's really just it should be about. And that's something that somebody asked me the other day. It's like, well, I don't want to, and I respect it, but let's say it's meditation. It could be a Vipassana, a 10-day retreat. You know that when we feel fragile in our ego, and we don't really want to know what's inside there. We're like, better not to stir it up. Better not to knock it loose because. You know, what's in there really? And I think that what's in there, like you said, is our essential nature. And if we have that guidance and that support around it, that really that's where we're headed, then that's what I told somebody. It's what I got from my vision quest. It's like, what's in deep inside it? It's your favorite you, you know? It's the favorite you. It's not the one you don't want. It's the one you love, you know? It's the one that you love being. Like that's the one that's deep in there. And so that should be the guiding light, you know, I think of what you were talking about.
Love it. Yeah. That's a great vision.
Yeah.
To rest in.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Source of laughter. Yes.
Yeah. We're amazing.
Yeah.
Accept it.
That's good. That's good. Well, thank you, Paul. I think I'm going to wrap it up because we're pushing into the hour. We could talk for hours and hours, and it would be wonderful. But just to give people something to listen to for a little while. And, is there anything you want to say, finish up with? Or when can we – what's your book's timeline? Any ideas?
There will be a book within, say, 9 months.
Oh, wow. Wonderful.
How's that?
That's great. Perfect. Perfect. All right. Well, thank you very much, Paul. It's great to have you on the show.
Thank you, Joe. Wonderful to connect. As always.
Yes.
Next time we'll do it out on the waves.
That's the way. Yes. All right. Thank you.
Thank you once again for listening to the Modern Spirit podcast. New episodes will be trickling along. For now, please learn more about our work on modernspirit.org. Please also consider supporting our research project. The Modern Spirit Epigenetics Project. You can find a way to support our crowdfund through the website modernspirit.org. You can also sign up for the newsletter there, and we look forward to being in touch.